From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Welcome to this week's edition of Naps Chat. This is Bob Levy, the legislative and political director of Naps, and I'm here today with a returning friend and returning guest, Kevin Kosar, the vice president for research partnerships at the R Street Group. Kevin's experience and relationship with Naps goes back many years. He formerly served as the CRS analyst for over a decade, and the research manager, and he, under his portfolio, was the Postal Service. Currently, he is very involved in directing the governance department at R Street, and he's working with the Legislative Branch Capacity Working Group here at R Street also, and that's where we're sort of going to start our conversation. This week, Kevin testified before the House Committee with Jurisdiction over Congressional Modernization, which is chaired by Congressman Derek Kilmer from the state of Washington. During those hearings, Kevin spoke in some detail about the reasons why Congress is having a very challenging time in passing legislation and conducting what it's supposed to conduct under Article 1 of the Constitution. So, Kevin, what's the problem with Congress?
Well, Congress has a lot of problems, and for sure, partisanship is one of them. But much overlooked is Congress's capacity problem. What I like to say is that we should think of Congress like we think of any other organization. Does it have the resources? Does it have the internal processes? Does it have the internal organization, and et cetera, that sets it up for success vis-a-vis the tasks that it faces? And I think the evidence clearly indicates Congress does not have that.
Now, you began your conversation with today with the observation that most people have asserted the reason for Congress's problems is the partisanship. You take a different tack. You think that there are institutional problems that preclude the Congress from acting effectively and efficiently with regard to legislation.
Oh, absolutely. Now, to be clear, Congress does often choose to dodge hard issues. No argument there. But Congress also has a severe bandwidth problem. Go down to Capitol Hill, talk to members of Congress, talk to their staffs. They will use the phrase drinking from a fire hose all the time because the demands upon them are so immense. Over the last 100 years, we've gone from a federal government which was small-sized, modest, limited number of departments. It was manageable. Now it is an enormous thing. It's more than $4 trillion in spending each year. There's something like 180 federal agencies, workforce of more than 2 million civilian, couple million military. We're a global power with our hands and feet all over the world. A lot's going on, and our national legislature just has not invested in itself in a way and has not upgraded its capacities to meet the demands of the 21st century.
Interestingly, back in the late 1940s, 1947, during the Truman administration, Congress had that same sort of outlook that it didn't have the capacity to conduct oversight over the administration. So what they did is they reorganized Congress in the late 1940s. I think it was the 1947 Congressional Reorganization Act to better calibrate itself to conduct oversight and to sort of be a policy co-equal, or at least approach co-equality with the administration at that time. We've lost that capacity probably over the last decade or two.
Oh, yeah, we're grossly overdue for Congress to renovate itself. As you alluded to, it did so in a significant way in the 1940s in response to the fact that the executive branch had grown so immensely, what with the two world wars and the Great Depression. And it invested in itself to kind of reassert itself as the first branch. Then in the early 1970s, we saw a similar spasm of reform. We had the standing up of the Congressional Budget Office, for example, the recreation of the whole budget policy process, a lot of investments in congressional staff, reorganization committees, all sorts of stuff going on. We've seen hardly anything since then. In the early 1990s, Congress tried to renovate itself, but that got kneecapped because of partisan considerations. And then when Newt Gingrich came to town and took over, Congress reformed itself, but it actually slashed capacity.
Let's go back to that 1994 reorganization of Congress, or after the 94 election. The old House Post Office and Civil Service Committee was consolidated into, at that time, the House Committee on Government Operations. So you had a committee that two of its subcommittees, of its five subcommittees, actually focused on the Postal Service with staff expertise and policy expertise in that area. Since that point in time, let's look at the staff, because I know during your testimony before the House committee earlier this week, you focused on staff. What happened to the staff, and how do we build the staff expertise again, specifically to the Postal Service?
Yeah, so it's worth remembering that members of Congress are all amateurs. They are us. They come to Washington, D.C., and they don't have subject matter expertise in very many areas. This is why we have congressional staff. This is why we have nonpartisan civil service agencies like Government Accountability Office, Congressional Research Service, etc. These are the folks who provide institutional memory and honest expertise that can help legislators do their jobs on behalf of the public. Well, since the 1980s, we have seen a decline in the total number of all those staff. Legislative branch support agencies, they are way down. House of Representatives, the committee staff, down about 40%. And House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, where Postal now lives, that staff over the last 15 years is down more than 30%, with fewer of the staff actually working on policy and more of them working on other stuff.
And that's general to all congressional offices, that you have a shift of staff from policy to communications, politics, external affairs, sort of the political aspect of the congressional office rather than the legislative arena.
Yeah, the communications revolution. You know, we could say it started with 24-hour news with CNN, and then subsequently the rise of the internet. All that transparency, which we tend to value transparency, also comes with a cost. It places demands upon Congress to communicate. And unsurprisingly, members of Congress are increasingly, you know, allotting more and more of their staff towards doing communications activities. 10 years ago, you didn't have to worry about what people said on Twitter because there wasn't much Twitter.
you at the hearing, you referenced, and let me look at the quote, that Congress has spent less, quote, time on task than it has in the past. Is that attributable to the lack of staff expertise and congressional expertise in areas which would be on task?
Certainly, if you don't have enough people to do the work, then you can't have a hearing competently, and you certainly can't move legislation to the floor. It's the time on task problem. Just to give you a sense of the scope of it, when Congress was surveyed about 3-4 years ago, the survey reflected that members of Congress spend maybe 1/3 of their time on policymaking and oversight. The rest of it is raising money and politicking, in particular having to get on an airplane every week and fly back home in order to avoid the accusation that you've caught Potomac fever or become part of the establishment. So, yeah, they have very little time, and the congressional calendar has been altered to allow that to happen. So you have members of Congress who are frequently not here in town. And I know some Americans cheer and are like, good, Congress is not there. They're not passing laws. Yeah, it also means that Congress is not solving problems and that the president, basically, and the executive branch can do whatever they want.
We're going to talk a little about solving problems within the context of a report that was just released a couple of days ago on the Postal Service, the so-called 5-year strategic plan. But before we get into that, I'd like to sort of focus in the reason why I think this is such an interesting conversation we're having today. In less than 2 months from now, NAPS, National Association of Postal Supervisors, will be coming down for its annual legislative conference, the legislative training seminar, where we bring around 600 to 700 citizen lobbyists, postal supervisors, to lobby Congress. In as much as there isn't as much staff expertise as, let's say, 30 years ago on postal issues. How should our citizen lobbyists, who are members of NAPS, approach Congress and approach congressional staff on those issues that are vitally important to the Postal Service and to our members?
Well, I would first suggest that you approach them with the assumption in mind of that these are very harried individuals. They're often staff are, you know, only a few years of experience. They have 1,000 different topics to pay attention to. And therefore, they probably don't know your issue well, and they have limited bandwidth and capacity to take in. So when you communicate, I would say certainly do so with humility, do with the kind of tone and eye to educating the staff, and don't be shocked if they have kind of glazed looks on their face as if this is all very new to them, because it might be.
And one of the points that you brought up, I believe, at the hearing was that we have a staff turnover on Capitol Hill of approaching 21%. So every 5 years, you might have a complete staff turnover in a congressional office.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was something that I saw firsthand during my time at the Congressional Research Service. I mean, our job inside the Library of Congress were to be the nerds that Congress could depend upon to get schooled up on particular issues. And the number of times where I would train up a staffer on postal issues and then find myself a year or two later with that person having departed that office or moved on to another topic, having to start from fresh. Some 22-year-old, 23-year-old who didn't want to get in postal issues is suddenly given the issue by their boss and are like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. There's unions asking me questions. There's NAPS asking me questions. There's communications coming at me left and right. I don't even understand any of this. I saw that happen again and again and again, and it really makes it hard for groups like NAPS to kind of get a reform conversation going and have it sustained.
So your recommendation is start very basic, and from that basic conversation, continue that conversation beyond the time at which you're in Washington, because it has to sink in, and they have to sort of synthesize the information, and only after that synthesis can they actually act upon it?
Yes. And if there's some way where you can, in the process of it, also talk your member's district or home state so that they feel the bite. Again, members of Congress have a million problems put in front of them every day. They can't tackle them all. They can only deal with a few. In order for them to prioritize, you have to be able to put things to them in a way that it actually is going to grab them. And certainly if you can talk your district or your home state, that's going to be a lot more powerful.
One of the other interesting aspects of your testimony was the issue that Congress, because of its lack of capacity, has sort of squandered an opportunity for aggressive oversight of its agencies. The agencies have a high degree of staff expertise. They have the policy chops. Congress doesn't. With regard to the Postal Service and oversight of the Postal Service, that creates problems, the lack of congressional oversight, particularly with the issues that we're dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. I frequently tell people that postal politics and policy are some of the most difficult things on Capitol Hill. I mean, we're talking about a $65 billion a year enterprise, hundreds of thousands of employees, a global reach. I mean, it's complicated. And then you think about the diversity of the stakeholders involved and what they want, and the sheer complexity of the model, which is a self-funding government corporation chartered for a public purpose. It's tricky. It's inherently tricky on its own merits. And then when you throw in the factors of less committee staff, high committee staff turnover, and also the structure of the committees themselves. Think about House Oversight and Government Reform. It has a huge jurisdiction. It's dealing with impeachment, federal government computer network security issues. It deals with everything under the sun. Postal is just one of dozens of issues. Like Bob said, if we had a committee or a subcommittee that was dedicated to postal and related issues, we'd probably do better.
Yeah, the last time we actually had a subcommittee dealing exclusively with the Postal Service, I believe, was when it was chaired by John McHugh. And we're talking almost a generation ago.
Yeah. No, it's a little crazy. Government gets bigger and bigger. It works in more and more issue areas. Yet House of Representatives has the same number of committees, about 24. And yeah, it's got all these subcommittees, but subcommittee can't bring a bill to the floor. Subcommittee can't force a vote on something. So what you get is a massive stovepiping. Subcommittees can beaver away as best they can, and then the legislation goes up to the committee, and if the committee is too busy working on other stuff, it sits, and nothing happens. And then you hit election season like we're going into.
Yes.
And, we don't have time to be in D.C. We don't want to take tough votes. Nothing gets done.
And we have the added complication this year that we have a new chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, Carolyn Maloney, who has indicated interest in postal legislation, but she's new to the arena, and I believe she's going to be relying a lot on Jerry Conley and Steve Lynch and Brenda Lawrence and Mark Meadows for their sort of history with the legislation.
Yeah. So that's just one more variable. The loss of Elijah Cummings, who clearly cared about the topic and tried to work. I remember him working with Daryl Issa, two very different people, but working across the aisle and trying to get stuff done. Yeah, it's hard. And going back to the issue of partisanship, I mean, House Oversight and Government Reform and Senate Homeland Security, for that matter, they work on issues other than postal, which are really polarized and really rough. I mean, House is has been dealing with impeachment. You got to realize that the people who are working on those issues, they get mad at each other. They get frustrated. It's like a form of war. So it can be very difficult for them to kind of go from that mindset to like, oh, hey, let's talk about postal reform and let's see if we can do something collaborative. It's more easy for them to like feel burned from those hot fights that they're in and just go to separate corners.
Well, you know, it's going to provide a unique opportunity for our members that come into town the second week in March to sort of help bridge that divide, present them with a bipartisan or nonpartisan approach to postal reform legislation, and educate staff members no matter what party or where they come from in the country.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, been dealing with the postal issues since 2003. It's not inherently partisan. It's complex. It requires delicate coalition building. But this is really something that they can do. And it just doesn't lend itself to kind of crude electoral calculations the way something like impeachment may.
And Congressman Mark Meadows has demonstrated that, because there is no more partisan member of Congress I could think of than Mark Meadows, yet he has been probably the most visible working across the aisle on postal legislation.
Yeah. Yeah, and Mark's an example of the difference that people can make. You know, you can stock a committee with certain folks who are just toxic to one another and who just don't care about an issue, and therefore nothing's going to get done. Or you can, have people on a committee who happen to care about it and be willing to kind of do the rough work that, unfortunately, American citizens and even a lot of the interest groups, they just don't care about that sort of grinding through of the policy process, which requires hours and hours and hours of time. It's just not much respected. People tend to want to see results, and if they don't get results, they cast a pox upon Congress.
On both their houses. Mm-hmm. Let's shift gears a little bit, and we'll talk about a paper that was submitted this week, or actually released this week, by the Postal Service. It's 5-year strategic plan. And we both had the opportunity to review it, at least quickly go through it. And I'm just going to make one observation that I found fascinating. I'd like your comment on it. Actually, two comments. Number one is sort of like a question or comment. I don't think it replaces the 10-year strategic plan that was promised to Congress last year. Do you think that this is a replacement for it?
Unless they've cut that deal with the committee behind closed doors, no, this is not what was asked for, I don't think.
Okay, and I'm going to follow up with another observation. I went through the document twice. I didn't find any reference to the president's task force on the Postal Service that was released not long ago.
Yeah. I didn't see any reference to it either, and I'm not sure how to read that. I mean, maybe they just don't want to bring it up for the sake, because the president's plan clearly outraged some folks. It's hard to believe that it was a simple oversight.
Another area that I found to be interesting is the Postal Service's analysis of mail volume trends. They project over the next 5 years that mail volume will decline by 18%. That's by 2024, we're going to have 18% less mail in the system than we have today. Compounding that, or related to that, is that there'll be a 22% decline in per delivery point volume. So in that document, it concluded that there would be a 4% decline in revenue per delivery point with expanding delivery points. How do you, does this document sort of address that in any way, shape, or form? Or is it just sort of take note of this shrinking mail volume despite everything and anything that we're trying to do right now?
Yeah, I didn't see it said out loud, so maybe I read it into the Postal Service's plan. But it seems to me that what they're trying to do is to have higher margins. Volume goes down, but we're going to try to get higher margins on a lot of our products. And so the emphasis on the crossing mail with, you know, digital capacities, presumably you could price that higher. And if you do it right, you may get better margins on it and start replacing, you know, first class, which was so good. And then certainly the kind of indication that they're doubling down on e-commerce, and they're going to try to get more of that into the stream, although it's not clear to me if that's a great way to get more better margins or not.
What they seem to be with the parcel shipping business, they seem to be focusing on return of products to make it easier to return products that may not fit right, that may not be what you wanted, to have it almost like a picked up at your door, or to bring it to a post office to return and have some mechanism for expediting that process. Also a little bit more flexibility in the way in which it processes mail. Mm-hmm. They talk about relocation of processing plants, which is important to NAPS members, since a lot of our folks work in those processing plants. Those are some of the issues I think they are dealing with. But let me ask you this, because you contrasted this document as not being a transformational document. That means this is not not the Postal Service transforming itself. Rather, this is an evolutionary document. The Postal Service trying to evolve with the market. Can you make a distinction between what would be transformational in contrast to be what is evolutionary?
Yeah. Where's the line when evolution becomes transformation? I guess to use a different case to try to illustrate this a little bit better. You may have seen that Capital One has decided that it's going to transform how it does retail banking with the public. They're turning their banks into cafes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and places where you hang out and then you might kind of bump into a banker to discuss, you know, your 401k or something like that. That's closer to a transformation than an evolution, but it's still banking. It's still about, can we have your money and invest it in your behalf and loan it out to others? And still, it's still fundamentally a banking business, but it looks a lot different. Now, when I think of what the Postal Service is describing here, first and foremost, it doesn't look a lot different. I don't think anybody will walk by and their eyes will pop and be like, oh, is that a post office?
Should people want, I mean, post offices are very identifiable with the American mm-hmm. flag, and we sort of know what they look like. Would that be an advantage to look different?
I think the retail facilities in many cases could be spruced up. I think there are some that are gorgeous mm-hmm. and that are really kind of like national monuments, but a lot of them feel like 1950s with a 1980s makeover, and I feel for the workers in there with the tube lighting and the it doesn't feel particularly inspired in those environments, and I feel badly for the employees there, but you know, the Postal Service's ability to transform, as they would certainly say, is greatly limited by what statute allows them to do. You know, we had the 2006 Postal Accountability Enhancement Act, which clamped down on the kind of product and service offerings that the Postal Service could get into. And so, the Postal Service probably would have a hard time turning its lobby into a cafe and starting to run a restaurant on the side. I guess I took some issue with the fact that the Postal Service was kind of ballyhooing this as a transformation, when all it felt like to me is their two strategies were double down on intelligent mail and see if we can get bigger margins out of that, which they've been doing for a while, bless their hearts. And then second, let's go deeper into parcels, but let's try to somehow reorient our parcel business to care more about, you know, the average American's experience of parcel service via the Postal Service. And that was it.
They did mention a little bit, which I think is somewhat controversial in the legislative sort of approach to this plan, and that is to take a look at retirement and health benefits. It didn't just talk about the liability from pre-funding. It just said, let's look at benefits. Let's look at pricing, the CPI, the indexation of pricing. I mean, those are the tough nuts to crack. They didn't explicitly say what they wanted. Question is whether or not it's a sort of a repetition of what former Postmaster General Pat Donahoe was arguing for back, you know, prior to the outgoing Postmaster General Megan's tenure, or is it something different?
No, it sounds the same. I mean, you know, you're running the Postal Service and you're going, can I control costs better? Well, the first place you're going to probably look is towards your employees, who's comprised about 80% of the annual operating costs of the Postal Service. And then you say, I'm going to look at the revenue side of things. Ah, God, maybe we can get rid of these price caps. Maybe I can get a little more freedom to jack up the prices on certain stuff. Year after year, we hear that just put in different words.
Right. And one of the interesting charts that I found interesting, at least in this in the document, was that the only postal system which is less expensive than the Postal Service is the island of Malta. Every other postal system charges more for the delivery of domestic and regular mail, other than the postal, the USPS in Malta. I just found that fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the exception that proves the rule, that the postal service in this country is the exception to most postal services. I mean, I can't think of another postal service that has to deliver to the expanse that our postal service has to. We have to serve Virgin Islands. We have to serve Guam. We have to serve Alaska. We have to serve Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I mean, holy moly. And by the way, please do it 6 days a week.
And at the same price.
At a flat rate for most mail.
That's correct. That's sort of a culture that we've developed in our country, and people, in fact, postal customers expect that.
Yeah, although I would guess I'd ask you, do we mean the John Q. public customer, or do we mean the real customers, the major mailers?
Well, depends what side of the binoculars you're looking through.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress reacts primarily to their delivery point customers.
They do. They certainly care about, if folks are complaining about post office hours or mail arriving that's damaged or delayed, they get upset by that. But I would also say that the mailers have a pretty big megaphone in this town because they're organized and mm-hmm. they know what they're doing, and their business lifeblood is dependent upon this.
And that comes back to our legislative training seminar about educating members of Congress about our concerns, because a lot of these folks that are mailing interests do, in fact, have rather aggressive lobbyists in town who will argue quite successfully their position.
Yeah. Postal reform, to some degree, is inevitably a revenue versus cost fight. And different stakeholders care about different sides of the equation. If you're a mailer, you're not going to come to town and say, please jack up my rates 50%. I would love to help end the Postal Service's deficit. No, you're that would be self-destructive. You don't want to do that. So that's postal politics. It's tough.
And that is where the rubber meets the road.
Absolutely. And making sense of this complicated situation and the trade-offs involved, and trying to find common ground, that's what we have to do. And if only we had more staff who were dedicated to this and could be more schooled in the matter, we'd probably get postal reform sooner.
More staff who are educated about the issues and have members of Congress who listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
With that, Kevin, I just want to thank you for joining us once again, and hopefully we can call on you when other postal news or congressional news hits the newsstand.
I'd be delighted. Thank you.
Thank you, and till next week.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter. And maybe